This Week in Retronauts. Was that painful enough?
That was, what are we doing, the Dark Crystal?
That was the opera, man.
It's authentic.
I'm Draco.
Oh, sure.
God dang.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's very authentic.
Gargling musically. Perfect.
Thank you.
Like a Super NES. It's amazing. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm Jeremy Parrish, and we're going to talk about Final Fantasy VI this week. You may know it as Final Fantasy III, but your childhood lied to you. So with me here to discuss it is the same group that's been discussing other Final Fantasy games in tremendous depth. It's almost like we're doing this as a series of consistent discussions. I don't know. It's crazy. So, of course, across from me.
Hey, it's Bob Mackie, and I'm a sub of a submariner.
A submariner?
How does that work?
Namor is the submariner. I think.
I'm referring to Kefka's bad insult.
I think he's the son of a submariner.
Submariner, got it. Okay.
Someone who pilots submarines.
Why is that a bad thing? I'm sure a submariner makes a lot of money.
Well, you know, because the castle goes under the sand.
I see.
So, let's Skype Ted Woolsey. Maybe it's, you know, like some sort of low-paying job. It's like you're a janitor. You're the janitors of the seas.
This is more about the class system of that world.
I think so.
I needed
the
to know.
Caste system. yes. Also this week.
I'm Mr. Thou. That's my name. That name again is Mr. Thou.
Wow. That's awesome.
So Scion?
Hi, I'm Chris Kohler.
Hello, Chris
Kohler. Hello. Hi. Features editor at Kotaku.
Amazing.
And also frequent Final Fantasy podcaster on this year Retronauts.
Right on. Mm-hmm. And finally, rounding out the crew.
Hi, I'm Kat Bailey. I'm EIC of US Gamer. I don't think I was on the Final Fantasy V podcast, but
you weren't. You were on Final Fantasy IV,
You were busy that day.
But
you couldn't make it.
But I am here, and I am ready to talk about the best Final Fantasy ever made.
On the other hand, I have perfect attendance.
That's true.
I have to
be here. He has a little gold star next to his name. It's great. So yes, we have to date talked in great depth about Final Fantasy, Final Fantasy IV, Final Fantasy V, and now Final Fantasy VI. But wait, what about 2 and 3? No, sorry.
No.
We've talked a little bit about them. We're going to talk more about Final Fantasy II, the Japanese II, in the context of our upcoming Saga episode, because that's really where it belongs.
It's pretty much just a saga.
It was confused and had the wrong name. But that's okay, because the Saga games were also confused, and they had the wrong names. They thought they were Final Fantasy, but they weren't. So we'll get to that in another episode. Right now, though, we're talking about Final Fantasy VI. Actually, Final Fantasy VI was a little confused. And it had the wrong name. It thought it was Final Fantasy III, but it wasn't. We all knew better.
Which, like,
actually, we didn't.
Even though it was literally only like 6 years between, you know, the release of Final Fantasy III for the Super Nintendo in America and them putting it out as Final Fantasy VI on the PlayStation, you know, just a few years later, it's still the confusion lasts to this day.
It doesn't help that they just put the game.
Yeah.
So yeah, that confusion was just cemented by the Super NES Classic Edition, which releases Final Fantasy VI as Final Fantasy III, even though Nintendo has previously published Final Fantasy VI for Game Boy Advance as Final Fantasy VI Advance.
Right.
Well, but it's accurate.
They don't edit the ROMs. They don't want to go back and
but
change the title screen.
It's just not helping.
I did a heavy sigh because whenever you write about this game, you have to do that little semantic dance in a parenthetical every time. And I hate doing that. I want people to know, like, do we still need to tell people this? I don't think so.
But we are talking about the game specifically, well, because of the, you know, the progressive game-by-game overviews we've been doing, but also because it did just enter reissue status, you know, re-entered the market in America on the Super NES Classic Edition. So people are going to be playing it and being like, huh, I thought Final Fantasy III was that other game on DS. This is really weird.
Right, right, right.
So I don't know. I'm sure everyone knows at this point, but we're done. Yes.
If they didn't keep re-releasing it, yeah.
Yes.
And, you know, actually, Square Enix just released Final Fantasy IV, V, and VI, among other games, on Virtual Console on the 3DS in Japan.
Of course they did.
Yes.
Not in America.
Not in America.
Why would they do that in
America?
That
would be ridiculous.
That's silly.
Yeah.
Americans don't like Square Enix video games. Mm-hmm.
Especially not portable Square Enix games.
Yeah. Especially not beloved Final Fantasy games.
Let's just say it's possible. It's possible they might do two. You know, they might do it again. They might do Final Fantasy quote-unquote 2 and quote-unquote
I'm holding
three.
Out for a virtual console release on Switch at this point.
There may not be a virtual console on Switch at this point.
I wouldn't
Go
on a hunger strike or anything.
Yeah.
Nope. Holding out. Don't break my dreams.
I mean, you never know. Nintendo might have announced it by the time this episode comes out. They're so unpredictable. I mean, I never thought that they would bring Arcade Punch out again.
Yeah.
And yet they were like, hey, third-party hamster, why don't you republish our old arcade games?
Yep, yep.
Okay. So who freaking knows with Nintendo?
Who knows?
They're so unpredictable.
Whenever Nintendo doesn't do something, you always think there's a reason they're not doing it. But sometimes there's just no reason. And
like they
it's
didn't
like
even
the Arcade Punch
it.
Out. They're like, oh, yeah. We made those out. Okay, we should put those out. Yeah.
Should we put them on 3DS? No, that would make sense. Let's put it on Switch so we can have tiny, tiny little screens stacked up.
Well, if they do Tate mode.
They will. Hamster does that.
Hamster's good. Yeah.
They'll make it happen.
They will.
But still, like the video they showed of Punch-Out, like tiny, tiny, two tiny stacked screens. Yeah. I'm like, what is this, true pixel mode? Come on, guys. Oh, well. Anyway, that's not
those,
Final Fantasy VI.
Need those square pixels.
So Final Fantasy VI. I'm actually a little intimidated to talk about this game because it's so beloved.
Yep.
It is, like Kat said, she says it's the best Final Fantasy game. Not everyone agrees, but enough people agree that they have very heated opinions about it, discussions. Enough people don't agree that they are willing to take the other side of those heated discussions. It's kind of has a huge footprint in the nerd mind.
It's also a huge game. It's so
game.
Sprawling. I mean, when it came
it's
out,
almost
on,
like two games in one.
When it came out on the Super Nintendo, it really felt like a culmination of everything that had come before, in terms of the cast. I mean, it was an ensemble cast. It told so many different stories. It felt like almost an entire anime series crammed into one game.
yeah. It was like everything you loved about Japanese storytelling video games, and it's like it was all there. Yeah.
It was just huge. And so in that regard, it is actually kind of hard to know where to start.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm sure there are better Final Fantasies objectively, I'm putting in scare quotes, but I am the most into this one because it hit me at the exact right time. I was there on whatever day one was for this game in America, and it changed my – it kind of blew my mind as to what video games could do and the kind of stories they could tell. And this will stick with me forever. I was obsessed with this game as a kid, and I continue to have Final Fantasy VI obsession now.
It was my first proper Final Fantasy, actually. So.
Yeah,
I don't know if there is an objective. I don't want to get into this, but like it's like
I don't
know if you can pick out a Final Fantasy and say, "Oh, this is definitely 100% better than FF6" because even if FF6 has its flaws, which it does, I feel like every Final Fantasy game, game has like big holes in it. But
except 13.
It was not a of course, except for 13-2 obviously being the pinnacle of Lightning Returns. You can't even touch.
Don't even talk smack about Lightning Returns,
seriously.
Dude.
We're all fans in this room, I think.
But, I think every Final Fantasy game, has, issues. And so it's no Final Fantasy game is perfect, and therefore it doesn't have to be perfect to be the best.
Is the Final Fantasy game about working through everyone's issues.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's a subquest for everyone that lets you resolve their personal crisis.
So through, ambitious.
By killing things. It's really convenient.
Right. I mean, there wasn't really a whole lot of gameplay mechanics to,
I think history has just borne out the opinion that it's really, really good because, I mean, there were a couple of essential 100 best 100 RPG lists that went up recently, and mm-hmm. Final Fantasy VI and Chrono Trigger were pretty high up on both of them.
Yeah, actually, I mentioned this in this is the I'll try to only mention this book one time, but hi, I wrote a book about Final Fantasy V. It's available now from Boss Fight Books. And towards the end, I noted that, yeah, IGN and Game Informer, right at the exact same time, independently of each other, did lists of the best RPGs, the top 100 RPGs of all time. Literally, the articles were titled the same thing. Mm-hmm. And Final Fantasy VI was number two on both lists.
Yes, it was. But the number one was radically different.
It was. Yes, it certainly
what
was.
What were the number ones?
Skyrim and
yes.
Chrono Trigger. Okay.
Yeah. Whenever people talk about Final Fantasy VI and like ranking it, I almost never see people go, oh, this Final Fantasy is definitely better than Final Fantasy VI, but they will say, but I think Chrono Trigger was better than FF6. Like, that is the pinnacle is where
I always recommend if you want to start playing the Final Fantasy series, you want a really great game to start off playing if you've never played a Final Fantasy before, you should play Chrono Trigger. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a really, really fantastic Final Fantasy. That's also Dragon Quest. Just doesn't happen to be titled Final Fantasy. Yeah,
there was a real quality curve to Square's 16-bit output. Like, yeah. They started out very good, and you ended up with Chrono Trigger.
Right. I mean,
there was also sorts of stuff in Japan only. Like, I don't know if Romancing Saga 3 is any good, but it doesn't matter.
This was peak Square. Peak Square. Yes. The games that they were putting out, even stuff that was kind of off to the side, like Front Mission. Mm-hmm. Really, really good. I mean, it's not that they could do no wrong, but they sure were putting out a lot of all-time classics. They knew the SNES. They were comfortable with it.
And in incredibly rapid succession. I mean, this is still when games took like a year to develop.
This hits a sweet spot where the tech and the memory available to 16-bit systems were just big enough for them to go hog wild and give you a game with 14 party members and two alternate versions of the same world to fight through. That's pretty crazy. But the tech hadn't become so expansive that games became very expensive and convoluted and took a staff of 200 people to complete, as would be the case beginning with Final Fantasy VII.
Yep.
So it's like a great sweet spot between creative ambition and necessary technological restraint. And so those two things come together really well in this game in a way that complements one another as opposed to working as diametric opposites. You don't see that a lot, but when it happens, you get games like Final Fantasy VI.
If I may, I would like to draw a parallel really quickly between Final Fantasy VI and Dragon Quest VI, which was also kind of the pinnacle of the series on the SNES. Mm. I mean, a lot of people would say Dragon Quest VI is not the best game, but it was certainly one of the most ambitious. It was one of the best looking on that console. But it was also very much in the classic Dragon Quest mold outside of the addition of, I mean, the return to jobs, I suppose. Whereas Final Fantasy VI really blew up the formula. Like, up to this point, we had kind of followed roughly the same path. You had the crystals and everything. Mm-hmm. A lot of the story beats were kind of the same and that kind of thing. And then Final Fantasy VI said, no. Totally different world for one thing. We're going full steampunk here. We are introducing kind of a new history. Crystals are by the wayside.
Well, Final Fantasy V nukes the crystals. It blows them up.
Yep.
And it's like they took that as an opportunity to sort of say, like, let's take off that burden. Let's remove that from our shoulders and just go with something different. Let's observe this sort of continuity within the series.
Right.
It's not crystals anymore.
And it's like there's – you know, Final Fantasy VI has how many castles? Like two? I want to say two. I want to say Figaro and Doma.
Yeah.
And I think that's it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
So it's like they kind of broke out of that because Final Fantasy V, just like 4, was very much like castle town.
Yeah, and one of the castles is a super like Gundam machine that can transform and burrow under the sand and travel beneath the ground.
Yep.
Not your typical castle, really.
I want that castle. Final Fantasy VI, I mean, the reason I brought up Dragon Quest VI was they're both huge. Mm-hmm. They were really big games. It's just that Final Fantasy VI was ambitious in the sense of we're completely redoing the formula. And I think that was the difference between FF6 and DQ. Dragon Quest at that time.
Yeah. I again, in this book that I'm not mentioning anymore, I kind of said, like, I think Final Fantasy V was, like, the last of the first gen of Final Fantasy, mm-hmm. where they really kind of perfected the original Final Fantasy concept. And then with FF6, it was, like, a big sort of break. Sakaguchi stepped down as director and became producer. And it does seem like he really sort of took on less of a hands-on role because – Chrono Trigger, which I think is going to keep coming up in this podcast, started development. As far as I know, Chrono Trigger started development at the same time as Final Fantasy VI.
Well, Sakaguchi was also just really busy in general because there were so many games coming out.
Sure, but
he had to start planning a bad movie.
Sakaguchi was producing FF6 and Chrono Trigger. And so basically he ascended to be supervising two games that were happening simultaneously.
So yeah, a lot of people, I think the standard kind of way of thought is to think of Final Fantasy VII as the beginning of a new generation of Final Fantasy games because technologically, visually, yes.
Sure, platform.
But yeah, you know, but Final Fantasy VI really does a lot of the things that VII also did. It just does it with 16-bit sprites. And,
yeah, I agree.
Like the idea of completely mutable characters who don't have the restraints of the class system. Like the class system basically goes away once you get Magisite.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, all of a sudden you have the ability to turn your characters into anything you want combat-wise. You can customize their stats if you jigger around Magisite. You can give them any and all spells. You can do crazy game-breaking things with them that was not possible even in Final Fantasy V. And people say, well, that's not good gameplay. That's not good game design. It's terribly balanced. Okay, but it's cool to be able to figure out the systems and say, you know what? I can actually beat the final boss before he takes a second turn because he gets a free move when the battle starts. And if you cast Quick on yourself and then like spam him with Ultima and have like the gym box that gives you like double casting and the economizer that turns everything into one magic point cost – congratulations, you destroy the final boss before anyone gets another turn in that battle.
Right. Yeah, I think this was definitely...
That's not balanced, but who cares? It's so cool.
Yeah.
Six was definitely a turning point in the series as far as appearance, where I feel like there was a decision made where they said, these games will look as good as we can possibly make them look. And that was definitely not the case in 4 and 5. They looked kind of lesser compared to other Super Famicom games of the time, for sure.
Yeah, I picked up Final Fantasy VI. It was the first Final Fantasy game that I bought. And I bought it because I was like, Final Fantasy, I don't know if I really want to play this, but there was a commercial on TV, there's a sale at Target, and I really enjoyed Secret of Mana. And like for the first time, I was like, video, you know, RPGs can look good. Secret of Mana looks really good. And this is another game that looks really good. So I played it and didn't really expect to fall in love with it. I kind of expected to skim off of it like I had previous Final Fantasy games. Like I beat them, but I didn't really get into them. But this one just pulled me in immediately, and I had to see it all the way through. I like skipped social engagements and locked myself in my dorm room and was like, I'm playing this game. Shut up. Leave me alone. And I loved it, and I immediately set about playing it again. I went out and bought the guidebook so I could like break the systems and figure out what all of Gao's transformations were and so on and so forth. Like I got really fixated on this game, not like – you know, not an unhealthy obsession. I kind of oversold it there. But it just really caught me. And all like at that point, I became an RPG fan.
Okay.
Really an RPG fan.
I think I've told the story on the podcast before, but I got a Super Nintendo in 1999 of somebody at work gave me one for free. And I brought it home and I was like, what should I play on this? Well, I would like a really long game. And I don't normally like these RPG things, but Nintendo Power told me that Final Fantasy III is really long and really epic. And I'm like, okay, well, maybe I'll get that. And I do like customizing parties. That could be a lot of fun. So I picked it up from a local Funko Land for $50. And luckily, they still had it and at a reasonable price too. And brought it home. And as you said, it really made me an RPG fan because there are still scenes that obviously are really famous. I kind of did cry when Cid died and Celeste threw herself off the cliff because I was kind of an emo teenager and that kind of thing. And it was Final Fantasy VII that truly solidified that because that game completely blew me away. But VI was where it started for me.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I fell in love with RPGs with IV because it was the first one my brain could sort of comprehend and understand. Like, okay, I like RPGs now. And then I bought VI for the alarming price of $80 in 1994. And I was like, oh, I really love RPGs. And this is what got me really into them and really into especially the music. Like this, I like the music of the older games, but this was the first time I was like, oh, this music is great. I'm going to record this off of my TV with a shitty little like handheld cassette recorder.
I spent $40 in 1994 to get the soundtrack.
The Kefco's Domain soundtrack, yeah.
Oh, you got that?
I did. Nice. It was a lot of money to spend at that time three CDs. But yep. By God, it was worth it.
Yeah, by the mid to slightly late 90s, like by 96, 97, I remember my friend passing me some MP2s.
They hadn't evolved
files of the Final Fantasy VI soundtrack. Yeah, yep.
Yeah, I when I played this, I named Terra after a girl that I had a crush on.
Nice. Was
stupid, but whatever. Because the girl that I had a crush on dyed her hair green, so I was like, cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was like, Terra's got green hair.
Yeah.
And then I named everyone after Star Wars characters, and it worked surprisingly well. Locke was Han Solo.
Right.
And Celeste was Leia. I was like,
hey.
Everything kind of works out this way. Huh. Umaro was Chewbacca.
Right.
Yeah. Wicket. I don't know.
At the time, I was in a writer's group, and we were just kind of writing stories together and kind of chaining them together. It wasn't based on any one particular thing. We were just having fun writing. And I named all of the characters after characters from that, except for the main character, Terra, who I named after myself because that's what I like to do.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was really happy. I was like, yay, a girl is a main character, and I can totally name her after myself. Sweet.
And then she stops being the main character after like 5 minutes.
And then she disappears.
She faints, and it's Locke all of a sudden.
Yep.
I'm horrified by this. I never changed the characters' names in Final Fantasy.
Well,
Did you leave them in all caps?
No,
yeah,
I
was
going to
say. I took them out of all caps.
I only changed the names to get them back to their original intended Japanese versions, such as Cayenne and Tina.
Mashu.
As well as Mashu. Yeah.
I had a similar I played Final Fantasy I back in the day and was like, I don't like that. Like, we got it very cheaply, like garage sale or something, and I was like, I don't like this. RPGs are dumb. And then Final Fantasy II came out, and I was like, well, clearly I'm not going to play this because I don't like it. And then played Secret of Mana and was like, oh, this is amazing. And then
was it because it was an action game?
Because it was an action game. And then a friend lent me a copy of Final Fantasy IV, and I'm like, oh, this
I
actually –
get it now.
Turns out this actually is good. And so, yeah, for Final Fantasy III, that Christmas, it was Final Fantasy III, Donkey Kong Country. And I was like, this is the only two things I want for Christmas. So I did get them. One of those turned out to be a great decision.
I got them both, and I played up to the Treetop Village in Donkey Kong Country and was like, you know what? I want to play through Final Fantasy III again. So
Come on, man. DKC wasn't that bad.
It was fine, but it just didn't grab me, whereas I was like, I've got to go back to that world. I remember one of the things about this game that really, really sticks in my memory was I woke up one Saturday and my roommate was out of town for some reason. So I was just like, you know what? I'm just going to play. So I started up my save in the floating continent and played for like an hour or so. And then I was going to go out and hang out with my friends. And I got to the end of the world. And I was like legitimately just like, I can't believe this just happened. Like everyone's dead.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Like it ruined my day. I was like,
oh no.
I was like stunned that it happened, and I felt just like crushed that everyone died. And then, you know, there's Celeste and she's the only one alive, and even her grandpa died. Oh my God. What? So yeah, like it's weird how these little like goofy, super deformed, chubby headed sprites can be so gripping. But there was just something about the really great natural dialogue, which you didn't see in games that much back then, and the expressiveness of it and just the pacing of everything just really was an unprecedented experience.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah, for sure.
Really just like it – yeah, like Bob, I was like – I did not know video games could do this.
And the sprites in this game could act a lot more. They had like five expressions as opposed to two, like raising an arm or lowering their head. They could do quite a few things.
But, they could laugh. They could blink their eyes. Yeah. They could kneel down. Yeah, I mean there was a lot going on. Yeah.
I had played plenty of PC games through the 90s, and they all had really good stories and really good graphics.
Sure.
But I don't know. Like Final Fantasy VI felt epic in a way that even those games did. And I didn't know that video games could actually be.
Yeah, like even a King's Quest game, it felt like that took place in the span of like a day, mm-hmm. you know? But Final Fantasy VI, you really got this feeling of like this was something that was like going on for years and years, especially because of that huge
break.
Right,
the big time gap, yeah.
Yeah.
Like Solus is unconscious for how long?
A year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, yeah, things change.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pretty brave decision. And I do want to talk about the end of the world. Maybe it's kind of weird to start a discussion of the game with a discussion of its like big mid-game plot twist.
It's not even so much like that it's the plot twist, but it's like –
Yeah, I mean the game kind of gave it away because it came with a map that had World of Balance, World of Ruin
on
it. So but I was like, something's going to happen.
But this is the fact that it is separated into these two worlds is the sort of fundamental design element of Final Fantasy VI. Everything flows from that.
In my notes, I wrote that you really have to talk about the balance and ruin worlds and the narrative together because it's really like story and game mechanics, world design
mm-hmm.
matching together. Like I really feel like Final Fantasy VI wants to be the culmination of Final Fantasy IV and V. And the way it does this is by basically being both games. In the World of Balance, it's a very linear game. You have a party that's pretty much always predetermined until sort of later on when you can pick your party. Your characters can't be customized. Everyone has a fixed skill. Like Terra can transform and use magic. Celis can use magic. But everyone else just uses their class skills. And class is not overtly presented. There's like a description, I think, not even in the English version. Does it?
What?
I think, does the Super NES version actually say what their class is? I don't think it does.
I think it does.
They took that out for the US version.
No, they just introduced them as like, here is this person and they're sad about something.
Yeah, yeah. But like
give
the
them
menu
a name.
Screen, it gives them the class. Yeah.
Does it give them the class?
I think so. It does in the Game Boy Advance version. That's
in the GBA version it does, but I don't think in the original game it does.
So
the class system is there, but it's sort of understatement. So like Sabin is a monk.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of using like, you know, Yang's commands, like in Final Fantasy V, it's a completely different set of commands. He's a Street Fighter character.
Yep.
He uses Hadoukens and he uses like
forward and
backward and 360 degree.
Which at that time, when they started development in 93, Street Fighter would have been at the absolute height of its popularity in Japan.
So they put a Street Fighter character in there.
Everybody's probably playing Street Fighter. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, so then you have some characters whose classes don't work that well. Like the samurai class really sucks in this. The charge attack, like you have to like bring your party to a standstill so
like,
Cyan can charge up attacks that aren't really
point?
That great.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Like the only use people find for Cyan is to turn him into an imp and give him like the imp halberd and
turn
him into a berserk character.
Do you know what the imp halberd is called in the Game Boy Advance version?
Is it like the anus poker or something?
It is. No, it's called, and this is really, you're going to love this. You're going to love this.
Because the imp is a kappa.
Yeah. The imp,
water demon.
Right. So there's a spear that he can use exclusively, or not exclusively, but it's really powerful when held by an imp. It's the imp halberd, I believe, in the original. In the Game Boy Advance version, is called the imp partisan.
Oh.
That's too clever.
Yeah.
Yeah, too much.
One of them.
Funnily enough, I actually had Cyan in my original party when I beat that game because, I mean, I was new to RPGs. Everybody else had pretty esoteric abilities. Like, I did not understand Gao at all. I was like, what do I do? Where do I go to do the thing?
Yeah.
But whereas with Cyan, it was like, just watch the little meter power up and then you use the attack. I'm like, oh, that makes perfect sense to me.
We didn't get Final Fantasy III Japan or Final Fantasy V, so I didn't understand that Mog is a geomancer / berserker. I didn't understand
/ dancer.
Yeah. He's like a little bit of everything.
He is.
I didn't understand that. Like, I got that Locke was a thief.
Right.
But yeah, like, you know,
well,
Edgar, he's an engineer. That's not even in the previous
games. You don't
games.
Have to understand that.
No, but I didn't. I didn't get where its roots were. But anyway, all of that becomes irrelevant about a third of the way through the game when you're introduced to the magic system.
Ish.
About a third-ish. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, it becomes irrelevant-ish.
Your skills become – your character-specific skills become much less important.
Less important.
Terra definitely – hers becomes better and better the further you get into the game. Mm-hmm. But like Celis is never – like her skill is never good outside of the one demo battle.
I still forget what Runic even does.
It absorbs fire, lightning, and ice magic.
I see.
And it turns it into like that – the amount of MP that it would take to cast the spell.
What is her job class?
She's a runic knight.
Okay. Yeah. That had never been in the games though, right?
Well, I think it's supposed to be like an inverted
swordmaster.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be like an inverted sorcerer from Final Fantasy V.
That was another ability.
But she's really only good against the tunnel armor and against Kefka. And after that, the first Kefka fight.
The first Kefka fight.
Yeah.
And after that, it's like, okay, you're just going to use cool magic. Need it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, actually, she's just so I've been – so I've been playing the game on the Game Boy Advance. And it's really interesting the difference between like Teenage Chris and now Chris, which is – and also Super NES versus Game Boy Advance. Teenage Chris really just wanted to get through that game and beat it so I could beat the game and see the ending. Now Chris is like, whatever, I'll just fight Tyrannosaurus for an hour just to kill some time. This is fun. I don't want this game to end. So, yeah, I'm like at the beginning of the World of Ruin, and I have like maybe half the characters so far, and like Edgar's level 50. Everybody else is level 45 something because I just keep, you know, building magic levels. And it got to the point where just today before I came out here, it was like, Celis learned Blizzaga. And I'm like, oh, like okay. Out of nowhere. Like, she didn't have the – I don't have that Esper yet.
Yeah.
But because Celis and Terra will sometimes just learn high-level magic, I was like, oh, snap. I really should stop leveling. It's probably a bad idea.
Right. So as I was saying, like the class system becomes pretty moot. There are some characters who still can use it, but everyone
Edgar's chainsaw, like right now, is doing 5,000 damage for me for free.
Blue magic
like,
is still fun to use. Gao's crazy attacks are fun
Saban's
to use.
Saban's attacks are still pretty good too.
Cat scratch with Gao, you can learn that very early. You can learn that immediately in the veld.
So unbalanced,
and it just does 5,000 damage.
That's why it's
whatever.
The game of ruin because the world of ruin because the game has no balance. But then, shortly after you get Magicite, everything changes, and the game goes from being this linear story to completely open-ended. And you basically have total control over the flow of the game, the sequence in which you go. You have to do certain things in order. You have to go find Saban. And
you do.
Yeah, I think you do.
Oh, do you?
I think meeting Saban is like the kind of point that galvanizes Celis, and then she...
I'm pretty sure you have to jump on the internet. You just keep talking.
Okay. I tried looking this up and I couldn't find it. I looked around, like, what are the mandatory characters? But I think there's just four mandatory characters. Celis, Saban, Edgar helps you navigate the world with his castle. And then you find Setzer, who finds another airship, even though he had the only one in the world, and allows you to navigate the world overhead. And if you have those four characters, you can go on to the end of the game and try to beat the final dungeon. And the only reason you need that many characters... You have to have three characters to beat the final dungeon because it's like a puzzle dungeon and you break into three separate teams. Better hope that you've used all your characters and leveled them up or you're going to have a lot of dead weight.
What I'm seeing is that you do not need to get Saban. That you can just – you just go Celis to Edgar and then to move Figaro and then you can find Setzer. Huh. And then you can take in – because you have to split your party up into three to beat the game. So – one character in each slot and good to go.
Yeah, the World of Ruin articulates itself much more like a Western RPG, and I have to wonder if that alienated Japanese fans of this game. I don't know what the pop. I'm sure it's popular in Japan. Actually, there was this weird sort of apocryphal story about how this game was, not a success in Japan. And I actually talked to Sakaguchi 2 years ago, and he's like, "No, this game was very successful."
Oh yeah, big time.
But I don't know. There was like this weird word of mouth on the internet that people didn't like this game. I don't know where that came from.
All kinds of weird stories happened.
But I wanted to clarify it with him for sure.
Yeah, no. So, I think that there was this idea of how do we square this circle? How do we give the player more freedom, you know, to wander around the world and really feel like they're on an adventure that they are determining, but also make, you know, have the pleasures of a linear story? So first half of the game is the traditional linear story, dumps you into the world of ruin, and after a little bit, it's like, okay, now you can go fight the end boss if you want to, but you can also go find your friends. And they signpost it. They do a Breath of the Wild kind of thing where they kind of like subtly tell you where to go next if you want to follow that path, because it's like, oh, I heard that,
yeah,
you know,
like a crazy ninja doing ninja things in a cave.
Right. That sort of thing. And then after that's all over, then it's like, oh, I hear that Gao is out there on the veld. Or that's before that. But you know what I mean.
And plus there are also the extra side quests. They release the Eight Dragons and Doom Gaze is out there.
Tons of things.
There's an absurd amount to do there.
And you can upgrade Espers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to avoid, like, because I haven't played the World of Ruin in a while, and I'm trying to avoid, like, just glancing at a FAQ every time I get confused, because I'm just sort of like, I'll just fly around and see what's out there and have some fun. Now, the one thing I definitely looked at the FAQ for, because I don't have time for this, was the Colosseum. Mm-hmm. Where I got to the Colosseum, just like, all right.
You have to wager something. Somebody, and if you wager the wrong thing, you just get blown away and lose it.
Yeah. You don't lose it.
I thought
you get blown away, you don't lose it.
Oh, okay.
But it's like, I don't – okay. Just tell me what to bet. It's like, oh, okay. Bet this and then that and then that and then that, and then you get Celis's best armor. You know, like, okay, great. Thank you. That's all I want to know.
Are we going to talk about how dumb the Colosseum is? Because it's pretty dumb.
It's dumbish. It's pretty dumb. You have to cheese it a lot.
I mean, the fact that you can't control your characters at all.
Well, that's the idea, right? I mean, you could just
build up. But it doesn't work, though. I mean, the AI is really bad.
I feel like
they were just doing random stuff.
They were borrowing more from Dragon Quest, because there are Colosseum battles in that game, but you're just watching monsters fight. You're not controlling
the
monsters.
They dumped so much stuff into it. Like, there were so many experimental ideas, that being one of them. There's the Colosseum, the auction house, all the stuff that doesn't take place in other Final Fantasy games, in which they introduce new mechanics and weirdness, and yeah, it's all sort of like half formed, and you know, none of it's really great. It just adds, I think, to the texture of the world. It's more of a textural thing than a gameplay thing, I think. Or just the fact that, like, really early on in this game, it splits your party up and it's like, oh, these three people went three different places. Pick what story you want to follow. That's cool. That's weird. Yeah.
I think it's really interesting because Takashi Tokita did not work on this game. He worked on Final Fantasy IV and then moved on to work on Chrono Trigger, I think. But he, you know, I talked to him a long time ago and he said his background was theater, and that inspired a lot of ideas in 6 and 4. And you can feel that influence still trickling into this game. It really feels like a play. And the points where you get to, like, the stop and someone comes out and actually talks to you and says, like, where do you go next? Which story do you follow?
Yep.
How exciting? What's going to happen now? Feels very much like, you know, like a production of Peter Pan or something.
Well, I mean,
very stage show.
The entire game is sort of themed as if it were an opera, and there's an opera scene in it, and we should mention this is like obvious trivia, but the two main female characters are basically the broken up name of a famous opera, La Celestina. So Celis and Tina, that's where it comes from. But yeah,
like really?
The operatic theming, I thought this was obvious.
I did not know that.
I'm sorry, but that's where it comes from. And I feel like this very theatrical theme, if you want to call it that, is baked in throughout the game.
Yeah, I always thought the character names, at least in English, were supposed to be like diametric opposites, like Terra Earth and Celis, like the celestial heavens. I don't know. Okay, that's cool. I didn't realize the opera permeated the game that much. But why don't we talk about the opera? Because it is kind of one of the hallmark moments of RPGs, like the point at which
Do you want to kind of jump back? Because the opera is pretty close to the beginning of the game.
It is, yeah.
You want to jump back to the beginning of the game and then go from there? Sorry.
We could. I mean, we're talking about the opera, so it's fine. We can treat this whole podcast like the World of Ruin. Whatever order we want.
That seems to be what we're doing.
Yeah, okay. Opera time.
I want to find Umaru.
So the thing with the opera is that it should be just, it should be the subject of ridicule. It should be just terrible. Everybody should be going out somewhere. Remember the opera scene where they're doing the on the Super Nintendo? But instead, it's amazing. It's one of the the iconic games and moments in games because, as we were already saying, we hadn't seen anything like it in a game before. I mean, what game had tried to be like, we're doing a full opera, the character is singing and everything, and it's the music is so good that you're
Despite the gargling voice samples.
The gargling voice samples, you're actually being moved by it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was the most extended and ambitious interactive story scene in a game I'd ever played. Maybe just in all of gamedom. It's like a 20-minute long scene with all of these different teams splitting up and it cutting between what's happening above the stage, what's happening on the stage.
You're fighting the Earth Dragon around here too, right?
That's in the World of Ruin. Yeah.
In the original version, you know, when you're doing the opera,
you're fighting Ultros.
You're fighting Ultros, yes. The recurring villain who is like out for revenge because he's angry at your party. So he's like, I'm going to get my revenge. I'm going to drop a 2-ton weight on the lead singer. And you're Celis is masquerading as Maria because she looks a lot like Maria, the diva of the opera. And so to lure Setzer in so they can steal his airship, she's like masquerading as the opera diva. So she learns the opera and you actually have to play through.
The funny thing with Ultros is that he comes in halfway through this whole thing and he's like, ha-ha, and I'm going to drop the weight on.
The weight's 2 tons and it's so heavy.
Yeah, but then nobody reads the letter.
Did we mention?
He drops the letter. He's like, aha, now you'll have to read this letter and find out my plan. But nobody reads it, so nobody knows what he's doing.
Also,
they're just concerned that Setzer is going to kidnap Maria.
Right.
And then there's a timer element, like it's a timed event where you have to fight through because Ultros is like, oh, this weight's so heavy. It's going to take me, I think, 3 minutes to drop it. A three-minute timer starts and you have to beat Ultros before the timer drops.
For as elegant and as beautiful as the scene is, they are not taking themselves that seriously. They're just saying this is a game segment and they're hanging a lantern on that with that timer that's explicitly stated by the villain. It's great.
Ultros breaks the narrative in a great way.
And the game's really funny, and Ultros is a huge part of that. He's a hilarious character. And by the way, he's also an octopus.
Yeah, he comes back.
He doesn't even know it. He doesn't realize until Realm draws him with her paint ability.
Oh,
and then he's like,
right.
Wait, I'm just an ugly octopus? He's so devastated. It's such a weird thing. Like, there's so much solemnity in this game. But yeah, they really just – it's, you know, like Osamu Tezuka, you know, just – there's no topic so serious like, oh, here's, you know, Jewish friends, a German friend torn apart by the harrowing experience of World War II. Also, here's some comedy pratfalls with a guy with a big nose. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this spirit really kind of comes through. Like, it's okay to mix heavy drama with just absurdity. And I think the game is stronger for it. And it works in this format in a way that it wouldn't work in a modern Final Fantasy game because you are controlling little chubby-headed sprites. And so there's only so much realism you can expect out of the game.
I would actually argue that a game that did nail it, a game that we're playing through right now, is Final Fantasy IX, which was a hilarious game with many hilarious vignettes and asides. And that was actually not that far away from being a modern Final Fantasy game. Mm-hmm. So I would actually argue that you could pull it off.
Well, it still had the sort of super deformed style that they've moved away from. Like the games are too realistic now, too, you know, characters have proper body proportions.
So is this a sign that they should go and be a little more stylized in the appearance of their characters?
I'd be okay with that. But, I mean, there's going to be like the mobile version of Final Fantasy 15. Does that count?
Mm.
Yes.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, I don't really necessarily see Final Fantasy going back, you know, sliding back to the way it was in the 16-bit era.
No, I don't either.
I think Square just has too much invested in like pushing the boundaries of graphics and realism and drama. So it just won't happen. But there is definitely something to be mined there. And I think the Tokyo RPG Factory is trying to mine that.
Uh-huh.
It didn't quite work with
very small budgets.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, those games were made on small budgets in a different circumstance, but still. I don't think it quite worked with I Am Setsuna, but I'm hoping Lost Sphere turns out better, a little closer to the spirit of the 16-bit.
What about Octopath Traveler?
Is that Tokyo RPG Factory?
It's Square, though, right?
It is Square. But it's more like the Bravely Default group, and it's more like Saga.
But it's articulating itself through the 16-bit sprites, though.
And not only that, it looks like Final Fantasy VI.
It really does, yeah.
Like the art style is very similar.
I'm playing that tonight so I can talk about it in the Saga episode.
You mentioned Ultros, I just thought of Octopath.
So. Oh.
Nice.
So we talked about Sakaguchi's role in the game, but we didn't really talk about the other people who were sort of the leads on it. And the two big creative leads as Sakaguchi stepped back were Yoshinori Kitase, who had worked on Final Fantasy V as like a story planner.
Yeah, it was like – I mean basically Sakaguchi describes it as he was kind of his co-director, his right-hand man. Like they kind of wrote the story together and
And then there was Hiroyuki Ito, who had designed the systems for Final Fantasy III. Four and five. And so
he was the creator of the active time battle system,
and,
right?
So this was, you know, the next evolution of that.
These two guys taking more of a hands-on role.
So I'm sure he was the one responsible for cool things like Saban using Street Fighter attacks.
Yep.
And things that didn't quite work, like Cyan holding up the battle while he leveled up to attack eight.
I forget, in the original release, was this the first ATB with a with an explicit meter shown to the player? Because they've added those in further re-releases.
Five had the meter.
It did on the original release?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So we had talked about how Final Fantasy VI was really the beginning of the next generation of Square. And it's really evident in here because obviously Kitase and company would have a huge role going forward. Also, this is a Final Fantasy in which Nomura starts to rise to prominence because he designs a couple of characters, Setzer and Shadow, and oh my god, those characters are so Nomura.
Yep, they're very him, as it says in the notes.
Yeah. Well, originally, both of those characters were ideas for Final Fantasy V, I believe, like for Final Fantasy V jobs. Like, oh, a gambler, and oh, a ninja with a dog. And then it was like,
Shinobi,
No, not so much, but you know, maybe Final Fantasy VI, Yeah, there's a
I forgot about the dog. Like Shadow's interceptor is a big part of the game and also subject to a very annoying bug.
Oh, why? What's the interceptor bug?
There's a bug where you can lose interceptor forever. He's a status. He's a status on Shadow, like a permanent status.
Okay.
But there is an ability that lets you like reverse statuses and transfer statuses onto enemies.
Oh,
so you can give Shadow or its interceptor status to a bad guy and kill it. And that's it.
And that's
You'll never get Interceptor back.
Oh, no.
It's terrible.
Poor Interceptor.
Wow.
Speaking of bugs, I believe one of the stats, or at least one of the stats, is meaningless in the original release. Is
evasion.
Evasion, yeah. Doesn't matter at all.
There are many bugs in Final Fantasy VI. The most notable one being the X-Zone bug, which is rather
Vanish
famous.
Vanish X-Zone.
Yes.
I consider it a feature for beating that annoying Cyan Dream Boss.
Yeah, there is that. Do you want to talk about that one?
Yeah, basically you would use Vanish on an enemy, and then if you use X-Zone, you were guaranteed to hit it and kill it.
Even bosses.
Doom also
even bosses.
Worked.
So
yeah,
that's how you could roll through the entire game.
Doom or death works with less regularity.
Less
okay. Yeah, I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, but there's basically something like enemies aren't supposed to be able to be turned invisible, but if you – some of them – but like there's zero resistance on enemies, and if you give them Vanish status, then they lose all resistances. So instant kill attacks, which should be a zero efficiency effectiveness, become 256 or whatever, and you always succeed. So yeah, that's a great way to cheese pretty much anything in the game that you can turn invisible. So we were talking about Shadow and Setzer, and they're actually emblematic of one of the design philosophies behind this game that I didn't know about until I was researching this episode, and that is that the characters' designs were all handled by different members of the team. So I knew that Kitase had designed Celis, but and like done the you know the end of the world thing and the opera, like those were his ideas. But what I didn't realize that was that like everyone on the team, all the team leads, came up with a couple of characters and also came up with scenarios for each of those characters. So the idea was like each character could be the hero. They could be the lead character if you want them to be. And so they were given that sort of like you know, a background and also some sort of plot resolution. Some are better than others. Like, yeah. I don't really care that Strago is angry and sad about a monster he couldn't kill when he was a kid. But on the other hand, Cyan is kind of heartbreaking because his family is killed by Kefka. And so he's haunted by, like, the memory of them and the fact that he wasn't able to save them for the rest of the game. And, it, you know, he ultimately has to resolve that.
I think a lot of people would say Cyan's story outside of the World of Ruin stuff is one of the most memorable aspects of the entire game because, I mean, first of all, you watch his family get poisoned and die.
Yep. Yeah, you do.
His wife and child are dead. And you
they die on screen.
You see their bodies there. And by the way, Kefka's just having a great old time here.
Oh, yeah.
And I think we need to talk about Kefka in more detail later. But yeah, so that's terrible. You watch everybody die instantly. And then the next scene is the Phantom Train, which putting aside the hilarity of Saban being able to suplex it, which is another very famous moment, you see him waving goodbye to his wife and child on the ghost train, which just blew me away. When I played this game back in the day, I was just like, whoa, that's heavy.
Yeah, and that sequence doesn't end with like a bang. It ends with the train going off and Saban and Shadow are like, we just need to let him have his time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And it just kind of fades out quietly. So, and this is very, very non-bombastic.
I mean, that entire scene starts almost as a Disney haunted house kind of thing. And then it ends on a just a really sad and tragic note.
It's full of goofy ghosts for a while that serve you dinner and stuff.
Yeah. I also like the fact that there's a translation error because the opera conductor later in the game was renamed Impresario, and they used like the same value for the train conductor. So the train is also engineered by or like, you know, driven by an impresario as opposed to a conductor.
There's
just like little goofy things like that that they didn't quite catch. But, you know, that kind of just makes the game a little more memorable.
So right.
Does everybody have a favorite character just out of curiosity?
Mog.
Mog is mine too. As useless as I found his dance abilities, he needed to be in my party at all times. And I would draw Moogles all over everything in like 7th and 8th grade. I was obsessed with Mog.
I really liked Celeste because in my mind she has some of the absolute best moments in the entire story. A lot of people think that she's one of the all-time best characters in Final Fantasy. I mean, she starts out as a villain. You don't even know if she's kind of a spy maybe. And in fact, I believe originally she was intended to be a spy.
Ooh.
But she was not ultimately. And I really like Terra as well. Her story is tragic. But as you said, she fades to the background and Celeste really steps forward in the World of Ruins. So she is one of my all-time favorite characters for sure. And I think she's awesome.
Yeah, I really want to say Edgar because when I played this game, I was like Edgar. I was a nerdy guy who liked, you know, gizmos and computers.
And you harassed
the equivalent.
Women.
And I had long blonde hair, but the woman harassment thing, I'm like, I can't really relate to that. I'm not like that. So I guess I think Terra, just in, you know, I can't really separate the characters' personalities from their mechanics. So the fact that she's so great in battle when she really gets a hold on her transformation ability, which boosts her power. Like that makes her a must have character in my party. And I would always give her like the Atma weapon. There's two Atma weapons in the game. One of them is a monster who's like basically the boss of the floating continent, the midpoint boss of the game. It apparently is really difficult, but I've never really, like, people always talk about how hard it is. And I beat
him on my first try.
Yeah, I always just kind of like blasted through him.
But
so I was probably too leveled up.
He feels like a final boss.
Yeah, he does. And then you're like, oh, there's a whole second half of the game.
That's the game. That's the head fake. But yeah, right.
But then there's the second Atma weapon, which you find along the way, and it's a sword. Mm. And the more health you have, the more the longer the blade gets, for one thing. The spray changes. So you get like at the end of the game, you have this like gigantic pink blade killing people. But it also becomes stronger. And, you know, as you take damage, the blade becomes weaker and shorter. So it's kind of a little cool feature, and it kind of behooves you to keep a character boosted. But yeah, like she can still use those attacks when she's in her Esper mode. And so
it's like a pink person with a giant pink blade.
Yes,
embracing like, justice.
Die with pinkness. It's like Kirby's revenge. Talk about the Esper system and the Magicite system. Mm. These are a big part of the story. You know, instead of having crystals this time, you have magical beings, basically summons, who have been turned into crystal, which I guess it's not
stretch.
Like the elemental crystal, but yeah. You know, they got that little element in there. You have like they almost look like, I don't know, like pill bugs or something. They're like little metal oval things with a square on them.
Yeah.
It's like somehow when a magical being dies, it turns into that. But I guess it's like the story is that they found a way to kill magical beings from another realm and turn them into weapons. They've mm-hmm. weaponized it. It's,
yep.
It's America, the yeah. RPG.
And this is not the first – nice. And this is not the first time that the summoned monsters have been integrated into the story because, of course, they were in Final Fantasy IV also.
Right.
You travel to their world.
Yeah.
This is the first time that they become very important to the story though.
Even before they were summonable, you still, you know, had to go meet up with Bahamut for the rat tail contest in Final Fantasy I. So like that little bit was always there, that thread, and they just wove the entire game, like the whole fabric of Final Fantasy VI once you get the Magicite system in place is about maximizing and minimizing and min-maxing yep. Espers and Magicite.
I don't know if what they're called in Japan, these summon creatures, but I believe Esper is
they're called summon creatures.
Just like literally.
Yeah,
I don't know the actual word, but I think Esper is a Woolseyism because there's the ESP thing in there. But have they been retconned and being called Eidolons?
I believe
in
Final
the
Fantasy VI Advance renamed them Eidolons.
I know Eidolons is what they – no? They don't?
No.
Okay.
Six Advance is Espers.
Oh.
Interesting, yeah, because I know
– I'll be hornswoggled.
I think 9 was the first time I saw Eidolon as the official – like the, from this point on, this is what these things are called. So.
Yeah.
So the main thrust of Final Fantasy VI's Esper system is that you are equipping these Espers and you're learning abilities and magic from them. And they're very good in that regard. And you can use that to really break the game in a lot of respects. And in that, it reminds me of Final Fantasy VIII, actually, which has a very similar system where you junction summons to your character. And from that point on, can set which ability you want to learn, and that is a huge part of breaking that game on
yes,
open.
But there are no repeated drawn-out animations of summons in this game. In fact, you can only summon an Esper once per battle. So
I forgot about that.
Right. You can't lean on them. But you know, a lot of their abilities carry over from Final Fantasy V, like Golem once again kind of creates a barrier that will block physical damage toward your party for a fixed amount of like the – I think the higher your level, the more hit points it can absorb or something.
And certain characters can learn certain spells at a faster rate if I'm
– I don't think so.
I don't know about that. No, Terra and Celis both learn magic innately because the whole storyline is that they've basically been infused – well, Celis has been infused with Esper magic – whereas Terra is half Esper. Her parents were an Esper and a human. And so she has the ability to draw on that side, and she's just naturally good at magic, which it can manifest itself in some pretty cool ways. Like the game begins with that iconic scene of the three ride armors – oh, that's Mega Man X – walking into the city of Narshe. And you have two Imperial soldiers, Vix and Wedge – or Biggs and Wedge if you prefer – and Terra, and you don't know her name. She's like she's in their thrall. She can't control herself. She's, you know, basically their servant. And they have four abilities and she has eight, all of which are way better, like more powerful from her. And things like Tech Missile basically can take out anything except the boss of that area in a single hit.
Yeah.
And she has the Bio Blaster, which if you hit humans with it, it's an instant kill pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, that kind of manifests itself. But otherwise – yeah, I think the characters are just like they learn magic.
They learn magic the same way. It's a multiplier. It's when you put the Esper on a character, it says, "Oh, this Esper will teach this character cure at a level of X3."
Yeah,
and so then when you gain one ability point, you get one AP in battle, they get 3 percentage points, and if you get 2, then they get 6 percentage points. But then some Espers teach magic at faster rates than others. So like the first Esper you get that has Cure Raw, Cure 2 on it, teaches it at a rate of 1. Yeah. So you have to fight. You have to gain at least 100 AP. And so you can do that if you want to grind it out and get that on your characters. But then later on, you get espers to teach it to you faster. It's like, okay, well, here, you can catch up now.
Yeah, it's like I think Shiva will teach you Blizzard and Blizzara for like very, very small multipliers.
Yeah.
And then later you get Tritok, the esper that's in the ice in the beginning of the game.
Right.
And he teaches all three classes of magic, like all three elemental magic types
yeah.
at a much faster rate.
Yeah, Maduin, who is Terra's dad, mm-hmm. teaches you Fire-Ra, Blizzara, and Thunder-Ra mm-hmm. at fairly fast rates.
Yeah, and each character has their own – like the two women have their own like innate specialties. Like Celis is mostly ice, and I think Terra is mostly fire.
Okay.
So they learn different spells yeah. as they level
but
up.
But that's just like a bonus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's just like you said, a way to accidentally get Blizzaga way before you're supposed to in the game.
Right. Basically, yeah.
And the Magicite gives you stat bonuses at level
yes.
ups
in and a way that – that's where the fussiness comes in.
I never broke the game in this way because I never played it with the intention of breaking it. I should go back.
Oh, that's right. I keep forgetting yeah. about all this. I forget about summon magic too. Like I forget that it's even a thing you can do in battle because it's not like in the list and you have to go in the magic and then scroll all the way up.
Right,
you always
right.
forget that it exists. But you're right. When you have a esper equipped on you, when you level up, some of those espers will give you a stat bonus on level up.
Right. And I think I never consider that because I'm more interested in learning the magic and mm-hmm. switching the espers around as much as possible.
Of course,
I'm not
of course,
devoted to
yeah.
being like, I want to keep this one on this guy for strength
yep.
and keep an eye on when he's going to level up so I yeah. get that strength boost.
If you are completely crazy about min-maxing this game and getting the most out of it, there are ways to basically mm-hmm. suck all the fun out of it. It's like spreadsheet yeah. gaming, but by God, you can do some crazy
much
stuff.
Much like Final Fantasy VIII.
They want – that's the idea, though, of – these – certainly a Final Fantasy game, certainly by this point, it's like they wanted you to be able to beat the game. And if you – it's like that's why they let you like grind for ability points in Final Fantasy V. And that's why they put things – like this game has in the advanced version the growth egg, which is a relic you can equip on a character. And then they get double the experience points. Mm-hmm. So if you need to race somebody to the top, you know, like they give you – If you're having trouble, you can go buy the strategy guide and it will tell you like, oh, you're having trouble. Well, go do this and then you can raise your levels more.
There's always a clever out for a lot of the challenges.
Yeah.
I remember like the Tower of Mages or whatever where you can only use magic in battles, but you can equip the Moogle Charm and just run up the tower and fight the boss. You don't need to fight in any battles. It's like,
of course.
Yeah, let's just do that instead right. of going through all this pain in the ass fighting.
Right.
Yeah, and
right.
there are lots of sort of expert level challenges in the game for people who really want to test themselves. There are the 8 dragons, some of which are very, very difficult mm-hmm. to defeat.
And yeah, they kick
the
my
price
ass.
For getting those is not that great.
It's not great. But it's
then,
like, but it's a thing to add into the world of Ruin mm-hmm. to give you something else to.
Yeah,
it's like
so you go back to the Opera House and oh, there's a dragon.
Yeah, that was that I felt when I went back there and saw that. That I felt was kind of like, well, that's anticlimactic. I mean, literally, okay, it's like, oh, I wonder what's going on at the Opera House. So it's like, there's a dragon.
Oh, it's the easiest dragon.
Yeah,
cast and float and you're good.
Yeah,
that's
you kill
the one
the dragon,
I killed.
And it's like, okay, like that was. That was sort of a disappointing part of the
That's
game.
That's because all the opera people have moved up to the Colosseum.
Right, right. You'd hope that something more interesting yeah. would happen at the Opera House than, like, there's a dragon. But, like, I do like that idea of, like, the World of Ruin just letting you do whatever you want. And it's like, okay, we've placed 8 bosses around the world. Let's see if you can find them.
Right. Oh, and on top of that, some of the quests, you know, most of the quests are optional. And some of them are very difficult. Like,
yeah.
the Tower of Mages, like Bob said, if you don't use the Moogle Charm to cheese it and get through there without any battles – it's a really grueling battle. It's a, you know, a grind fest to get to the top. But that's the only way you can get Strago back in your party.
Ah, yes.
And even if you make it all
the
way
to
the
– Oh, no. I think you can go to that tower and you can like get Strago and then leave.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I think it's kind of running around in a circle.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's the experience egg or something that's up there, the growth egg, I think.
No, I think –
Or the gem box?
I think it's either the gem box or the economizer.
Okay. It's one of the – it's something really good.
Yes.
But even if you make it all the way to the top through grinding battles,
yep.
very difficult.
Or Moogle Charm.
You have to fight the final boss and you have to like use all kinds of tricks to be able to damage him because he casts wall.
Yep.
And then when he dies, he casts the strongest magic spell in the game and will wipe out your party. It hits
yeah.
all members. The only way to survive that is to cast Life 3 on your party, which is a spell unique to this game, I think. I guess it's Arise in other games.
I'm not going to say it's unique
yeah.
to this game, but let's say that it's
I don't see it too often,
it's
but
rare. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, Arise,
Phoenix
which basically casts
Final Fantasy
auto. VII. Yeah, it casts auto revive on you.
Yep.
And Otherwise, your party will pretty much be wiped out unless you're extremely high level.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, I got up there and fought my way through, and he killed me when I defeated him. I was like, "You giant bastard!" But it didn't stop me from playing. I went back again, fought my way up, and used life three.
That's this game's equivalent of, you know, Omega and Shinryu. It's like it's a final exam. It's like, did you okay? Have you looked at everything that's available to you? Have you figured out what the solution to this puzzle is?
I love when games do that.
Yes.
People criticize Final Fantasy VI, they often focus on the Esper system and talk about how broken it is. Is this criticism warranted in your opinion?
I think it's pretty broken, but that's okay because you can abuse it or not. Like, you have the option. It's you know, within your power to choose how you play the game. And if you feel it's not ethical to like cheese the game, then don't. But I think it's interesting that the game doesn't even introduce this to you until like a third of the way through the entire quest.
Yeah.
Like, you get really far in using your class system and only two characters having magic, or three, I guess, by the time you get Strago. And then you finally get the skill system. It's kind of like a Dragon Quest VII thing where you're like, mm-hmm. oh, here's the actual system that you're supposed to use now that you've been playing for 10 hours or 12 hours. Or 20 hours in the case of Dragon Quest.
It's about 30. I just played
30,
through
okay.
it. Yeah.
Dragon Quest 7 is a little more drawn out than Final Fantasy 6. But you know, the idea is kind of similar. Like, it kind of pulls you in and lets you get a handle on the basic mechanics, and then it's like, okay, now go hog wild and make the party you want.
So mm-hmm. my counterpoint to that would be, aside from the fact that it makes all of the characters a little too samey, magic is so overpowered that you are just naturally funneled toward using it as much as possible. And the inevitable end result is that you're spamming Ultima to kill everything, which is not extremely fun.
Hmm. I didn't really notice that in any of my playthroughs, but I guess everyone approaches things differently. I kept using Sabin's
Sabin's attack too. Yeah.
His abilities, his monk abilities, and Terra's sword attack with the Ultima weapon or the Atma weapon.
I would actually be –
I guess that's supposed to be Ultimate Weapon, isn't it?
It is, and they changed that for Advance.
I see what Kat is saying, but I think I would agree more with her if not for Final Fantasy VII and VIII, which made that even more extreme with
it was
every character
much
being
more
the
extreme.
Same. Yeah, at least in VI you have those different mm-hmm. skills to give them some uniqueness to them, and then IX was like, okay, now we can introduce skills and magic again like in VI. But if VII and VIII didn't exist in their current form, I would totally agree with Kat, but I feel like the moves they made –
it could be so much worse.
Yes, yes.
So yeah, I mean, yes and no. Every character is the same. I mean, yes, you have all these magic spells to use, but I mean, I guess it depends on, you know, what you're playing and what you're doing. Like, I feel like, you know, I don't feel like Gao is the same character as Realm. I mean, yeah, you can teach them both Ultima if you want to, and then they kind of become interchangeable. But
yeah.
That's if you've got Ultima and the gem box and the economizer on them and you're just casting Ultima every round.
Right, but there's only one character who can do that. So, like, there's only one of those items unless you use some sort of bug to
multiply
things.
And you can steal economizers from like the Brachiosaurus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's only one gem box, though.
Yeah, okay.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's, you know, kind of like weird
or 99 unless you do the Realm Sketch glitch in the which is on the SNES Classic, so it's still a thing.
And
you can do it.
Hope that it doesn't completely delete your firmware
like, delete
on the Super NES Classic.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
The Realm Sketch bug. Okay, so there's a sketch bug. You know, Realm's ability is she's an artist. That's her class. Pictomancer, I think, is her talent name.
Yes, yeah.
And she paints an enemy. It's basically like I think the Ranger skill in Final Fantasy V where you can capture an enemy and then unleash it.
Yeah.
But it's instant. So you like see an enemy, you draw it, it appears and it uses some sort of monster magic, mm-hmm. monster skill. Okay, but if you use that on an invisible enemy, bad things happen.
Yep.
Kind of like the good things happen if you use Doom or X-Zone on an invisible enemy. But if you use Sketch, mm-hmm. she tries to paint something that's not there and the game goes –
and the game crashes.
The 5x0.
Yep.
And yes, basically. And so that has completely unpredictable effects. No one knows how it affects things, how it works.
Yeah.
But you can get like 99 of every rare item.
It alters your save file. And so basically then when you turn the save – yeah, you could delete your game.
Yep.
Or you could load up your game and you could have 99 of every item in your save file. Or it could glitch out your character names.
It's the missing note bug for Final Fantasy VI.
Right,
right. Pretty much, yeah.
By the way, because we're going to get emails, Realm I would say is more of the monster trainer class from Final Fantasy V, if anything.
Okay, yeah.
Because the ranger just calls on random animal friends, but the monster trainer can control
–
can capture and then release in another fight, which Realm can't do. It's more like control in which it forces the enemy to use a
I tend to use thing. Ranger and monster trainer together because they complement one another, so
they
get them confused.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And Gao is very it's sort of like Gao is like a combination of blue magic and
Berserker?
And Berserker and also like monster
and also copying. A little bit of monster copying. Yeah. It's they're both very unique spicy blends.
Yes.
Gao I think is a really interesting character that was like too clever by half because it's like what do you got to do? Okay, you have to bring him into this certain area into the game because of course
when you hear the drums you know you're ready.
You have to then he has to leave your party and it's funny. It's a really clever thing because he's feral, so he goes and he lives among the animals. And then he learns their secrets and then he comes back to you having learned the
but
secrets.
But it's random. Sometimes it happens immediately and sometimes you wander around for 5 minutes like, where is Gao?
Yeah. And then you have to go encounter an enemy somewhere in the world and then they'll start showing up in the Veldt, which is the only place you can do it because if you were to do it in other places, you could permanently lose him. It's like it has to be in this one area and it's all so complicated.
Yeah.
It's a really clever storyline, mix of storyline and gameplay, but it's like so complex. You got to get in Tangier. You got to get in Tangier. It's okay. All right, fine. So I fought in Tangier and then I go to the Veldt and then I wait until in Tangier comes up. He comes up. I have Gao learn the thing. And then in Tangier's ability is to kill himself, you know? It's just like, and the Gao dies. And I'm just like, well, that was worth it.
I love when Gao comes back from learning from monsters. He introduces himself to you again, like, hi,
it's
Gao.
Me.
He forgot
Don't
who he was.
Me.
Yeah.
Yep.
Gao, your friend.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun playing with Gao, and you know the second time I played through the game, it was like I'm going to get the most out of this, and played with the official strategy guide. But
he's a replay character for sure.
Yeah, and there is so much randomness to it. There's actually a system to how character like enemies appear on the Veld, but it's very complicated math.
Yeah, right. You're not supposed to understand it. It's supposed to appear to be random.
Right.
Yeah.
And that can be really frustrating. It's really frustrating when you send them off to learn something and then a really good enemy appears and you're like, I'm not going to see this guy for another like 12 battle cycles.
I know, you got to pick your battle. Mm. Yeah. As I said, get that stray cat so that he can do the move, which is called the stray cat strut, I think.
And
then once you do that, that's definitely it. And then you're just doing sick physical damage. So it's all you really need.
Yeah, and it's like element neutral, so it
right.
hits
it's just
anything.
It's like
as
the, it's like the,
hard.
It's like the goblin punch basically in the blue magic.
But
it's just
way better.
Super, super yeah.
Yeah. And then you know you
And
do
the
have...
stray cat only has two moves. The stray cat has attack an enemy and do the cat punch, whatever.
Yeah, so you're gonna do damage no matter what.
Cat scratch. That's
cat
it.
Scratch, yes. So yeah, there's all kinds of like super crazy stuff you can do once you find Gogo. Because he's a reference to Final Fantasy V. Like you find, you know, Gogo. You can meet Gogo and get the mime class.
I think he's just the same person and just exists across dimensions.
Maybe so. He's not the only reference to Final Fantasy V either, because Lone Wolf shows up as well.
Yes, that's right.
And Siegfried, who I don't know who he is, but people thought he was important for a long time.
Yeah, but he's not.
So yeah, Gogo in Final Fantasy V, if you beat him by not attacking, gives you the mime ability as like the final crystal, or crystal fragment. But here, you can actually just like go talk to him if you go inside the belly. Like you let an enemy suck your entire party in, which is very counterintuitive. But if an enemy devours your entire party, then there's a dungeon inside the monster. It's like a dune sandworm that has a cave inside of it. And he's hanging out. He's like, yeah, I've just been like hanging around here and it would be cool to go on an adventure. So I'll join up with you guys. Sure, why not? And he's so versatile. Like, you can do anything with him.
Sure.
Like, you can give him any character's special, unique command, multiple special commands.
They really bury that, though, within the menus. You have to kind of figure out how to give him those commands. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting.
But then the thing is, he doesn't – like, you can't control him. He just acts, right? Or no, can you use the special commands?
I forget. I haven't gotten to him in this playthrough, and it's been a while, so I forget.
Yeah.
I think you have to go to the
10 years since I've
played. You have to go to the status screen to assign him the different job roles, I think.
Yeah, it's really oblique, but yeah, if you think Magicite's broken, just wait till you get Gogo and start tampering with him and make him the most powerful character in your party.
But like, you wouldn't necessarily, I mean, I think when they were developing this game, it's like they were assuming that a lot of people would not find Gogo or that, you know, they would do it after turning to a strategy guide. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Umaro is, I mean, you like, if you want to get Mog back, like, you have to go to Narsh, right? So, I mean, there's, you know, you will probably see Umaro at some point. There's some references to him. Gogo, there's no references at all whatsoever. Yeah.
Yeah, Umaro is interesting because he's a berserker, so he can only do one thing, which is attack.
Yep.
But sometimes he can, like, pick up other characters and throw them for extra damage.
Yeah.
But there is one item in the game, one relic, the Blizzard Orb that you can give him.
What about the Bone Club?
That's a weapon. That's perma equipped on him. Yeah. You can't take it off.
Yeah, but the ice or the whatever it's called, the Blizzard Orb, he can equip, and it will cause him to randomly cast ice elemental spells, which, you know, that can be handy, but if you're up against an enemy that absorbs ice elements, it's actually really bad because it's a super powerful attack and basically you just gave your enemy back all its health.
Right, so why would you bring him into that?
Right, but it's a thing you can do.
Yep.
Because why not?
But yeah, I mean, there's they added so much to this. They put so much into this game. Like, any idea they had just went in.
Right, and there are characters who can die forever. Like, you can you can lose Shadow midway through the game if you don't stick around until the countdown of the undiscovered continent
that
up there.
That was me. Yep. I lost him permanently.
Yeah, I was like, okay, I got to go. And
well, it feels like a moral choice. It's like, do we have to wait for this guy? Because remember, up until this point, Shadow has been a butthole. Mm-hmm. Like, Shadow has shown absolutely no loyalty to you whatsoever. He comes into your party, he's
randomly
like, I'm done,
your party,
I need my money,
like,
and takes off. Right, exactly. And so then he ends up on the floating continent, he joins in, and he's just like, yeah, I guess I'll hang out with you guys. Then he leaves again, and it's just like, do I want to wait for him? It's like, what is the point of this?
Well,
it's like, oh, he will die.
He's working with the Empire. Like, you encounter him again on the floating continent, and he's been, like, cast aside.
They took all my money,
like,
and they...
Yeah, he's like, they beat me up and took my stuff.
Yep.
So you're like, okay, why don't you fight with us? And then he becomes a permanent member of your party if he actually, like, kind of self-sacrifices to try to stop the end of the world and it doesn't work out.
He does.
But you're like, well, I have, you know, 30 seconds to get off this thing and otherwise my party's going to die. And you've already been conditioned to deal with countdown timers by, like, the, you know, the Ultros battle.
Yep.
So you're like, well, this, you know, this was a big cutscene. There was a hard battle before it. I don't want to risk this.
Yeah.
So if you don't wait until like 3 seconds on the countdown, he's gone.
I believe you can lose Mog permanently too.
You can.
If you don't save him from being murdered by Lone Wolf.
Lone Wolf, you can like...
Is it like a menu option or something to
like
step
like
in?
Yeah, there's like a choice.
Yeah.
And you can either like...
And you really have
take
to...
Take something from Lone Wolf, like a Magicite.
It's the gold hairpin.
Yeah, okay.
And so basically Lone Wolf and Mog are both hanging over the cliff.
Oh, that was my favorite comic, yeah.
Lone Wolf and Mog.
So they're both clinging onto the side of opposite sides of the cliff. And then it's like, oh, he's got this treasure that we've pursued. Oh, but there's this Moogle we can save. And so it's really – you don't even know that Mog is going to become a member of your party at that point. So like, it's like, oh, geez, should I save the Moogle or should I get the treasure? So the idea is if you're greedy, you'll take the treasure and you'll have a treasure, but you'll lose Mog forever.
That's right. Actually, Mog is only a permanent party member in the World of Ruin, correct?
No.
Outside of that intro section.
No, when you get him, when you save him, he joins your party. Mm. But if you don't save him, he will not join your party.
Is that in the World of Balance or the World of Ruin?
World of Balance.
Okay, wow.
World of Balance.
I thought it was a bit later than that.
Well, no. So the skippable thing with Mog is that his best dance, which is the water dance.
The water dance.
You can only get it by going all the way back with him to the Serpent Trench and learning it in the Serpent Trench, because in the World of Ruin, there is no Serpent Trench anymore and there is no water area for him to learn that dance in.
We should mention.
And the thing is, you will never go back to the Serpent Trench for any gameplay reason whatsoever. So you have to like go all the way back. And then once
there
was you go
that eighth slot that bugged me. So I went back.
Mm. So once you go through it, you have to you actually have to like then walk your way back to your airship, which you left at the beginning of the Serpent Trench, although it's actually not that bad.
But, we should mention Serpent Trench and the Magitek Factory have two Mode 7 first-person sequences. I believe the Magitek Factory sequence is not interactive, but the Serpent Trench one, you decide which way to go.
There's like a minecart. I think you can choose.
The Serpent Trench is interactive. The Magitek Factory is not.
I think it's just the graphical effect to show you like you're going really fast.
I always try to control it. Okay,
but well, you might be thinking of the Mario RPG one, which is the kind of the same idea, but it's actually interactive.
Yeah. I got stuck this time for a long time in the freaking Magitek Factory because there's at one point you have to get on a conveyor belt.
Oh yeah.
And the conveyor belt is just there. You can't get on it from the north or the south. You can only get on it from the left hand side. But the game doesn't do anything to indicate that would be the case. So I like tried to get on it from the north and I couldn't. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess you just can't get on this.
Yeah, the Serpent Trench thing is actually where one of the more interesting glitches in the game can be exploited. There's a way to get General Leo like permanently in your party.
Oh, right.
By doing some like save exploits. So this is like before there was Revive Aerith. There was how can I make General Leo a member of my party? He's mm-hmm. the third of the Imperial generals. There's Celis, Kefka, and Leo, all of whom have been augmented with magic. And there's a brief period where it's getting close to the end of the world of balance and Kefka like knocks down your entire party. You're all out for the count, but General Leo steps in and you get to fight Kefka with Leo. And he has a really cool ability called Shock, which is literally just he holds up his sword. It's like the inverse of Runic and emits a shock and basically Kefka falls before him. But then Kefka like stabs him in the back. So people are like, wait a minute, I can play as him and he's really cool and I want him to be a part of my party forever. So they went to great lengths to figure out how General Leo could be a permanent party member. And people have figured out some glitches that makes the game completely unstable and weird. Yeah. But
oh, no.
What
you can basically do is so as soon as you get out of Narsh, right, you save the game right there. Right as soon as you hit the map screen, as soon as you hit the world map, save the game. Then you play through the world of balance until you get the airship, never saving the game. Then as soon as you get the airship, I believe that you die. And then the way the game works is that it doesn't boot you to the title screen.
Yeah, this game, no other Final Fantasy does this.
That's right. It brings you back to the last place you saved with all of the experience that you'd actually gained. Just no items or anything like that. But you save all your experience. But the airship flag is still turned on when it does that because, of course, they never found this bug because who in their right minds would ever do this?
Who in the world?
So now you're at the very beginning of the game or right as soon as you hit the world map with an airship. So now you can take that airship around and start totally breaking the game.
Yeah.
Leo in your party. You can do all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
If you go to the Let's Play archive, there is a great archive thread called Let's Break Final Fantasy VI. And it's basically like, how will the game react if I'm here when I'm not supposed to be? And it's really long and really great. And the game just like shits itself all the time. It's great to watch.
But it's interesting because you can figure out in a lot of those cases why it's reacting that way.
Yeah.
It expects a certain character to be there. And then the game has like redundancies and backups. So if like if a certain character isn't here, we'll put this other character in. And so that's how you get like cutscenes with like the wrong character and things like that. Yeah.
You mentioned General Leo. Is this the first black character in a Final Fantasy game?
Is he black?
I'm pretty sure he's black.
I don't know.
His skin is very dark. And he's got a mohawk.
I never read him that way.
Interesting.
But maybe. I saw him as just like a very tanned dude with a mohawk. But maybe you're right. I don't know. That'd be kind of cool because he's tough. But it does kind of get into like the black guy dies first.
I was thinking
cliche,
that actually.
Which, yeah. Not a good look.
Oh, I'm looking at the art and I'm pretty sure
that Biggs and Wedge die first anyway.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but as party members.
Yeah.
He has very pronounced lips in Amano's original art. Okay. So, yes, unfortunately.
I'll take that as word of God.
There was a lot of speculation that General Leo was going to be actually a member of your party because apparently if you hack him in, he appears in certain cutscenes, such as in the final sequence where you're confronting Kefka. Like, he'll like pop out and be there with the party. So people were speculating that that was part of the original concepts and that they ultimately said, no.
I also need to add that I'm looking at the original sketches for Amano's version of General Leo. One of the pieces of art is of him picking his nose. This is official art. He's picking his nose with his finger this.
Yeah, Amano just like draws stuff
rapid
fire, and sometimes it's really weird.
There's one character design he did from this game where there's like little like imps around the character. I forget which character that is. Maybe Cyan. Just like, I'll just draw a little imp here for no reason. But
Tara was Amano's favorite character to draw.
Hmm. But she looks like every other woman he draws.
Well, she's apparently
got pale hair.
He has said that she is his favorite character, and he incorporates her.
Well, you
into
know why? Because every single person who interviews him is always like, "What's your favorite character? What's your favorite character? What's your favorite character?" And he's like, "Oh God!"
She pops up a lot.
I get $20,000 for every drawing. Like, that's my favorite part.
Why don't we kind of wrap this up by talking about Kefka?
And we can talk about the final battle, too.
Tell me about Kefka.
A lot of people think that Kefka is the best villain in Final Fantasy.
And
he is, because he's the Joker, which is the best villain
in
Batman.
And maybe one of the best villains in gaming ever. And a lot of this is because he's just not just unrepentant and completely evil, but a psychopath, like a maniac. And we had not seen really a villain like that. I mean, we had seen plenty of pure evil guys, but not in the way that Kefka was pure evil, where he is clearly psychotic.
Yeah, a lot of Final Fantasy villains, they seem to a lot of the end bosses of Final Fantasy games would, like, I mean, certainly like Final Fantasy IV, where it's like the antagonist is Golbez all the way through, and then like the end boss of the game is this amorphous blob that came from nowhere.
But yeah, he's not.
But Kefka
chaos.
Is not. Kefka isn't. Yeah, he's not chaos. He's not Zeramus. But Kefka is a side character essentially that you keep, you know, running into while you think you're fighting the Emperor.
He's the henchman of the Emperor.
Yeah,
yes.
And then basically it's like, well, that's the, you know, he's the guy who kind of stabs the Emperor in the back and, you know, comes around and takes over everything. But
it's like, imagine if at the end of Return of the Jedi, Darth Vader chucks the Emperor down the shaft and then is like, you know what, this Death Star is pretty cool. I think I'm just going to blow stuff up.
Yeah.
Imagine if the Turks were the real villain of Final Fantasy VII. Because essentially the Emperor Gestal is Rufus from Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah. But back to your original point, Kefka, whereas typically Final Fantasy villains, they sometimes think they have a better understanding of the world than the heroes, and they're just sort of like, no, this is the way of all things, this is the way it must be, and you can sort of see where they're coming. They're wrong, but you can kind of see where they're coming from. Whereas Kefka is literally just evil, wants to kill everyone, wants to watch the world burn. Basically,
every villain that wants
enjoys
to be,
torture.
Every villain that wants to be God wants to recreate the world in some sort of ideal image. He's just like, I want to be God and also just fuck everything up constantly.
Okay,
because I'm God.
But the really great thing about Kefka is he's the villain who wins.
Yeah, he does.
He gets his aim. Yep. He wants to destroy the world and rule on high, and he totally does it.
Yeah, because that's what everybody's always threatening.
With his
laser.
He's
always, I will, you know,
he wipes out entire
towns. I'm going to wipe out the world, you know? Yeah, exactly.
His Kefka. Light of judgment.
Kefka
does
it.
That's what makes him interesting.
Right.
You kind of get to this point where you're like, once he rules everything, what happens then? Well, he's kind of got ennui. He's like, okay, well, I rule. What's next? I'm just going to be petulant and like step on people like ants because I'm a god.
Yep.
So, like, what's the end game there? Like, eventually he'll just kill everyone and then what?
Right, right, right.
Blow up himself? Go to another planet?
Maybe, maybe.
Well, I mean, it's just proof that being a psychotic killer is not an end of itself. It'll just burn itself out. But the other thing about Kefka is that he's one of the funniest characters in the game. He has many of the most memorable lines, stuff like, you sound like pages from a self-help book.
And when he makes the soldiers clean off his boots.
He has such comical animations when you see an army of characters marching and he's hopping up and down like going, ah. Yeah. I mean, he's hilarious.
He's supposed to be funny and he's supposed to be ridiculous and comic relief in the beginning of the game to make it so surprising that he is the end boss of the whole operation too.
And I was going to say that, of course, it helps that he has one of the most memorable themes in the entire game too. The second you hear that music, you know that something bad's going to happen because here comes Kefka.
And then you fight him at the end and that comical clown circus music turns into like a three-part prog rock 18-minute suite.
I guess we didn't mention the music at all, really, in this podcast.
Which is crazy.
Final Fantasy VI has
so
real good music.
That's why I mean, paid $40 for a CD.
I think we did mention a lot of this in the Uematsu episode.
It's his best work.
Yeah, yeah. It's I feel like other games use leitmotifs for just in general, but this one uses it on characters for the best emotional effect, attaching different songs to characters for more emotional moments. I think it was really effective.
Needed it because the game was so character driven because there were so many characters that everybody needed their own piece of character music.
And when you fight Kefka at the end, the final battle, it just completely blew me away. Back when I played the game for the first time, because I mean. You are just keep crawling up, right?
Right. And of course, the bottom of that sort of Kefka tower, like that in and of itself looks like it is a boss that you are fighting.
You're fighting through like the entire works of Hieronymus Bosch to get to Kefka, who is an angel at the end of it.
Yeah, right.
He's elevated himself not to a god but to an angel.
It's a pretty great final boss just because when it first moves upwards and it's like, oh, God, there's more. How tall does this thing get? What is up here? And then you get to the top of that statue and you're like, well, this has got to be it. It's the top of the statue. Oh, no.
Right. But then Kefka descends from the heavens. Yeah. The music changes. It's like a reprise of the title screen music. And then he opens the battle by reducing everyone's hit point to one.
Yes.
Like that's his opening sortie.
Yeah.
So, like, all of a sudden, you've gone through all of this, and you're on the brink of death.
And then you use a Megalixir.
Which at that point, at that point, you've got either a Megalixir or you've got Kuriga or whatever.
Sure, but at the same, when it happens, it's a heart attack for the first time. What am I going to do?
Right.
But he takes a long time to fire off his second attack.
He gives you the time to heal.
But it sure is a, kick in the pants.
It's supposed to be an FU. It's supposed to shock you, but then you're supposed to be able to bounce back from it without dying.
But that's a great use of play mechanics to reinforce the fact that, you're fighting God.
And also, that title screen music is so profound. Like, that title screen music is so catchy from the beginning of, like, what the hell game is this? The logo is on. It's not. It's on. Everything's on fire. You know. It's like
da,
this.
Da.
Yeah,
it has that, but then it has like this, like a stereo panning drum element that's like, kind of building up almost like a heartbeat. It's there's more filtering and echo right. and reverb and of course, the organ.
Every time you turn the game on, you hear that music. And mm-hmm. so then when you get the final battle, you hear it again as Kefka is descending. Oh, yeah, it's chills.
The best song in the game, though, is the ending theme because it is every song in the game, all in sequence, basically,
well, does that mean
and
the,
rearranged,
Does that
too.
Mean the best Subway sandwich is just all of the ingredients in one sandwich?
No, there is no provolone.
There is no best Subway sandwich.
The music is great all throughout this game, but that final battle suite is really incredible. And, you know, the fact that it's completely ripped off from Emerson, Lake and Palmer just makes me love it even more.
Yeah.
But it's so matches the battle because it has just like the battle, it has multiple phases.
Yeah.
And
there's actually
one into the other.
You may have heard this piece of music before because I think they used it in Napoleon Dynamite, but there is so Final Fantasy V, after Uematsu came back from Ireland recording Final Fantasy IV Celtic Moon, he got super into Irish music. And there was a point at which he was like, it's all I'm listening to these days. I'm super into it. Well, in Final Fantasy VI, there's a piece of music called Johnny C. Bad that plays occasionally. And the opening of that,
the like ragtime theme in the bars, right?
Yes.
Oh, sorry, cafes.
But the verse of that, the A section of that song is identical to a piece of music called Music for a Found Harmonium that was done by a band called Patrick Street that was a very, very big Irish traditional band.
Wow.
In the early 90s that, I mean, if Uematsu was going nuts just buying all the really popular Irish music – had to have heard this. So if you compare the two, Johnny C. Bad and Music for a Found Harmonium, they're not just close. It's the same melody.
Ooh, so yeah. You're accusing him of being a plagiarist.
There's a lot of this guy had to write like 50 songs a year. Like there's a lot of music in Final Fantasy
games.
Yeah,
considering the volume,
like,
it's three CDs of music.
Sounds a lot like other music, yeah.
It's three CDs of music that loop after 90 seconds.
And I don't think that he did it on purpose. I think that a lot of this stuff was sort of like, I mean, he just has to keep composing melodies. It's going to come from somewhere. And sometimes when you don't have perfect recall or the internet to check for things like that, like you might think you came up with something, but you really didn't. It happens accidentally.
Yeah. I don't think less of him for it. It's an amazing soundtrack.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, of course not. No. It's a wonderful, wonderful soundtrack. Yeah.
And many pieces of it have been kind of reworked. Like the opera has been given a proper finale because it doesn't actually end because you fight Ultros and dun, 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 dun. Like there's this kind of comical big timpani battle theme that doesn't appear anywhere else. And so he's actually like written a finale to it and people have performed the opera. And it sounds a lot more convincing when real people are singing it as opposed to
That was a big thing that everybody was after they started doing Final Fantasy concerts, you know, in the early 2000s. It was like, okay, when are they going to do the opera at one of these concerts? And they worked it in pretty early on. Yeah. So now if you go to a Final Fantasy concert, they'll probably do the opera.
And, you know, like the Black Mages, his heavy metal band that they used to be in, has done all kinds of like battle themes and that
sort
of thing.
Black Mages, when they started Dancing Mad. Yep, that's right.
And it's a great version.
Yep.
Yeah. So there's not really anything about this game I don't like. Yeah, it has some flaws and some balancing issues, but I like those. It's okay. They're part of the personality.
It's kind of RPGs at that time, a lot of the appeal of RPGs was that even if you weren't good at video games, you could get through this RPG. So, I mean, you are supposed to be able to just sort of like grind and level up and get through things and consult strategy guides and figure out ways around things. Like breaking it is a part of the game.
The point was that you're enjoying a story because stories weren't exactly prevalent in video games at that time.
And really being so ambitious and trying to give you two games in one, a linear story and then a non-linear story. Mm-hmm. But by giving you that linear story, making the first 20 hours of the game a linear story in which you're introduced to these characters and meet them all, then when you're thrown into the non-linear part, you already care about all these characters. These characters' story arcs are already on their way, so that you can then wrap all those arcs up in a non-linear way and gain the characters back in a non-linear way and still feel like there is structure. The structure is already there. And that, I think, was the genius of the two worlds, is that it gives you this ability to play the World of Ruin at your own pace, but not feel like it's like a saga game or it's like completely unstructured and you don't understand what's going on.
And getting back to what you said about a game anyone can beat, this is – we mentioned the game over feature where you keep your levels. This is the one time Final Fantasy has intersected with Dragon Quest in that sense. Dragon Quest has always had like you lose half your gold but you keep your experience because eventually with persistence you will be able to beat the game.
Yeah.
You will level up enough that you can win by brute force if you don't understand combat. It's the only time Final Fantasy has done that I can think of. Has there been any
that particular mechanic? Yes, yeah. I believe so, yeah.
But of course Final Fantasy would intersect much more closely with Dragon Quest in Chrono Trigger.
Indeed.
And that's the next deep dive that we'll do. So we'll save that for next time.
Yep.
But in the meantime, that's Final Fantasy VI.
And it really – and to understand, as I kind of said, like when you know that Sakaguchi was doing Final Fantasy VI and Chrono Trigger in tandem, it makes sense as to why Final Fantasy VI was a step back for him and why Final Fantasy VI – the people who worked on Final Fantasy VI did so and were able to be a little bit more free and to do new and interesting things is because – a lot of the people they worked with were now on Chrono Trigger, and Sakaguchi was overseeing both games.
Yep. So, Final Fantasy VI, we had a ton of reader letters, and we don't have time to read those. So, sorry about that, but we will read those in some capacity. I don't know what, but look forward to it because there were a lot of great responses to the call for mailbag info responses, whatever. Yes, I'm very tired. It's been 6 hours of recording. So, thanks everyone for listening. Thanks, Bob, Kat, and of course, Bob for being here.
Bob got thanked twice. Wow.
did I say Bob instead of Chris?
Bob,
Chris.
Kat, and Bob.
Bob, yep. Kat,
well,
Bob,
Bob. Kat, you know.
Bobcat Goldthwait has actually been here.
I like me some Final Fantasy VI.
We told you not to talk, Bobcat Goldthwait.
Chris.
We said he could be here
and
didn't
course,
talk.
Bob. Okay. So thanks, everyone. This has been a Retronauts podcast at retronauts.com, on iTunes, and on the Podcast One Network. As usual, we are supported by advertisements that you might hear if you're listening to this in the public feed, but also through Patreon support from cool people who are willing to hand over a few dollars a month to get access to podcasts a week early at a higher bitrate with no ads. It's a pretty good deal, I think. So your support keeps us alive and able to do this podcast. Like literally, it keeps me alive. It's and Bob too. It's our way of life.
Don't kill us, please.
Please. So you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, at the Retronauts Patreon, sorry, is at patreon.com/retronauts. Hooray. As for myself, you can find me at Retronauts on YouTube and at Twitter. Yes, that place. Twitter as GameSpite. Whew, I'm done talking now.
I'll go next. Hey, it's Bob Mackey. You can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. My other podcast is Talking Simpsons every Wednesday on the Laser Time Podcast Network. Go to TalkingSimpsons.com or look for Talking Simpsons in your podcast device. Every Wednesday, a brand new episode about an old Simpsons episode. We're going in chronological order. We also have a Patreon. That's Patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. We have so many things to offer you on that. Too much to mention here. I'll mention one thing. We're doing all of the episodes of The Critic with the Talking Simpsons approach. So if you like The Critic, you want to hear us play clips, explain references, and just have a lot of fun, go to patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons and support the show. Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Chris Kohler. You can find all the stuff that I'm writing these days at Kotaku, kotaku.com, which is a website about anime and snacks. I want to really make sure that I, again, formally let everybody know I did write a book about old school Final Fantasy. It is called Final Fantasy V. It's mostly about Final Fantasy V, but not entirely about Final Fantasy V.
It's also about young Chris and his Kokoro.
It is, yes, indeed. It's available. It's from Boss Fight Books. It's on Amazon. It's on BossFightBooks.com, and it's like only $5 for the ebook if you want to just, you know, if you don't want to buy in too much. But if you want it in a handsome paperback format with cover design by Corey Schmitz, who also did the logo for the Shadow of the Colossus remake. I know, yeah. You can buy it and learn more about Final Fantasy.
And I'm Cap Bailey. You can find me at my site, usgamer.net, which we have a lot of good stuff for retro fans who might be listening to this podcast. We also have a couple podcasts. One is the US Gamer podcast. And you should also check out Axe of the Blood God. If you're enjoying this Final Fantasy VI deep dive, we are currently in the midst of a Final Fantasy IX deep dive in which each episode we are basically progressing through the game and talking about it with each episode. So you should join us for that.
And that wraps it up for this episode of Retronauts. You can, of course, play Final Fantasy III on the Super NES Classic Edition if you can find it. Who knows? In the meantime, we'll be back in a week with another podcast and on some random Friday, alternating Fridays with a micro podcast. So be excited about that.